This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Stress can make us sick. Dr. Bruce McEwen has been studying why. He's written a new book about the paradox of how the human body responds to stress. The physiological response to stress helps us cope in the short term, like pumping adrenaline so that we can run away from danger. But when the stress response is activated over the long term, it can cause damage and accelerate disease. Dr. McEwen's new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. He's the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University in New York City and specializes in studying the interactions between the brain, the glands, and the immune system. He's coined a new term to describe the long-term effect of stress on our body systems when the stress response turns against us and starts harming the body. That term is allostatic load. I asked him to explain what it means.
There are two parts to it. First, the parent term, allostasis, which is a word that sounds very strange, but it means from the Greek, literally, maintaining stability through change. It's the active coping response, physiologic coping response, how the body expends energy to meet a challenge and usually succeeds in adapting to, at least in the short run, to this challenge and surviving. That's the whole purpose of these systems in the body that help us handle these stressors that we experience. For each event of allostasis, there are downstream consequences for the body. Cells in the brain, cells in the immune system, cells in the heart, cells in the liver, all over the body are responding to the mediators, the hormones, and the neurotransmitters that are produced. But there's another side to this, which is a set of changes in these cells that, if they repeat over and over again, can cause wear and tear and even put the body into a state of what we call pathophysiology, something leading to atherosclerosis, to hardening of the arteries, to changes in the body that are damaging. That we call allostatic load, almost an inevitable cost to the body of being alive, if you will.
So allostasis is what the body does to keep you going when you're exposed, for instance, to great risks or to threats. And allostatic load is the long-term consequences of what your body is doing in the face of stress.
It's the wear and tear that's almost inevitable for organisms that are functioning in an active world.
Let's talk about the difference between the long-term and the short-term effects mm-hmm. of these chemicals on our body when we're under stress. Let's start with adrenaline and the heart rate. When we're under stress, our heart beats more quickly so we could run away from the cause of stress. Because the assumption the body's making is that you're being attacked by a lion or an enemy of some sort. So talk about why the heart is beating fast.
Okay. So adrenaline is produced. It gets the heart beating fast so that we can pump the blood to make this mad dash away from a predator. But at the same time, as the heart is pumping, the blood vessels are being expanded and they're being subjected to a certain amount of stress and strain, I mean, in the physical sense. And if this goes on a lot, which it does in all of us, it can cause some minor damage to the blood vessels. And those are places where the atherosclerotic plaques, the fatty deposits that cause these coronary arteries to clog up, they begin to be deposited. So this very act of pumping the blood can also, over long periods of time, cause cumulative wear and tear, leading to atherosclerosis, which is made worse if we're eating a rich diet with a lot of fats and if we have certain genetic predispositions.
Now, let's get to cortisol, which is something that helps you, again, if you're under stress and you need to run away mm-hmm. from the enemy. What are some of the bad effects of a long-term increase of cortisol?
Long-term increase of cortisol leads to encourages the metabolic system to produce fat. It also causes muscle proteins to be broken down, to be converted to fat and to usable energy. It causes gradual loss of mineral from bone and weakens bone. And over long periods of time, it can cause cells in the brain to shrink, and under very dire circumstances, it can actually cause some cells to die.
Now, one of the things you consider a real recipe for disaster, if you're under a lot of stress, is eating a big dinner or a big late dinner. Mm-hmm. What does that have to do with stress and with cortisol levels?
It doesn't have a lot to do with stress. This is one of the reasons that we need to look at a broader view of what cortisol is. It's a hormone not only of response to stressful situations in our lives, but it's a basic housekeeping hormone that is secreted in a diurnal rhythm. It's elevated in the morning, and it should go down to low levels at night. And it helps to synchronize our activity, our patterns of eating, our patterns of sleeping. When cortisol is elevated in the evening, and a large meal will cause it to be elevated. A large meal at almost any time of the day will, but in the evening it's particularly dangerous because our liver has a biological clock too. And it happens that our liver's biological clock makes it particularly susceptible to have elevated cortisol in the evening, because that leads then to the conditions that cause the liver to produce more of these bad fats that are deposited in the wrong places in our body.
So eating a lot at night, not a good idea.
It's not a good idea.
And even worse if you're under stress because you've already got a high cortisol
right.
level.
And your stress may cause you to eat more just as a behavioral antidote to feeling better, eating comfort foods because you feel stressed out. So it's a positive feedback loop.
So it's like a vicious cycle.
A vicious cycle, yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen. He's the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at the Rockefeller University in New York City. He studies stress and stress hormones and their effects on the brain. He studies stress and health. His new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. If most of your cause of stress is happening while you're in a chair, mm-hmm. office stress, stress at home where you're, you know, sitting around the dinner table, say, and it's very stressful, or, you know, people basically are in chair so much of their life now. All of that fight or flight stuff isn't going to be real helpful because you're sitting still.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What happens?
You may be grabbing the wrong things to eat as well.
Yeah, but say you're not. Say you're not even grabbing the wrong things mm-hmm. to eat. What are some of the long-term issues that you can get health-wise as a result of this kind of stress if you're not doing much physical activity, if you're basically leading a pretty sedentary life?
One of the most immediate or first signs is an elevation of blood glucose levels, a resistance to your own hormone insulin, the beginnings of what could become type 2 diabetes, which of course is very prevalent now.
Well, why is that happening?
I think partly because people are consuming more calories than their bodies need for the amount of energy they expend. They're also using eating as a way of dealing with feeling under pressure. They're responding to the commercialism we see around us in terms of the marketing of food and providing larger meals than we need and feeling the sense that we have to get our money's worth. And so we do consume more than we really need.
Now hormonally, what's happening that contributes to
hormonally,
the glucose problems?
When you eat a fat-rich diet, when you consume a lot of calories, the body is producing more of these same hormones, more cortisol and more adrenaline. Under those conditions, the cortisol and the adrenaline work to make the body work with insulin to make the body produce more fat. The more calories we have in our bodies leads to something called oxidative stress. Oxidative stress is what is directly responsible for damaging blood vessels in the brain and in the heart, and leading to the production of more what are called inflammatory cytokines. These are hormones of the immune system, but they're also produced by cells throughout the body, by cells in the blood vessel wall linings, by circulating immune cells, these inflammatory cytokines trigger again a cascade of events that increases the deposition of these atherosclerotic plaques.
My guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen, author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Bruce McEwen. He studies the long-term effects of stress on the body. Part of what you do is study the body's response to stress and all the different hormones that are secreted, the changes in neurotransmitters, and basically the biological response of the body to stress. If you were to examine a patient, could you tell by studying the release of these hormones and other secretions in the body, how much stress the person was under and how their body was reacting to it? In other words, is there a kind of more medical, biological diagnosis of stress now that we're capable of?
There is. I mean, the beginning, which is still very useful, is the measure of things like your cholesterol level, your high-density lipoproteins. This is part of a biological diagnosis of the allostatic load that your body is experiencing. We can expand that and have in studies that are done on fairly large groups of people to look at how their health is affected by various things like their education and income and so on, by measuring things like their waist-hip ratio, the amount of abdominal fat that they have. We can measure overnight production or in urine of cortisol and of adrenaline. And remember I said that it's supposed to come down at night. So in the sleeping hours, if it's elevated, that's a particularly sensitive time to tell you that the system is out of regulation. We can measure systolic and diastolic blood pressure. We can measure these things called inflammatory cytokines. We can measure something we haven't talked about yet, which is called heart rate variability, which is a sign of how it's like a shock absorber in your car. The heart rate has a beat-to-beat frequency, which is not perfectly regular. And there's a certain amount of variability in that, which helps to reduce the shock on the blood vessels that can accelerate atherosclerosis. And if you have low heart rate variability, then your system, your cardiovascular system, is much more vulnerable to the shock effects that will cause the atherosclerotic plaques.
But should we try to, like, chemically intervene in the body's response to stress? Like, if there's too much cortisol, should we be trying to manufacture a cortisol inhibitor?
Okay. That's that, and that's also a very interesting question. I think not, because one of the things, there is a cortisol inhibitor, which is actually the same. It's called RU486. Is the same as the drug that causes termination of pregnancy, because it will block not only the progesterone receptor, which is involved in pregnancy, but also the glucocorticoid receptor, which is involved in doing the things we're talking about. It has a different name, mifepristone. If you use it, the cortisol levels go up, because what you're doing is you're blocking negative feedback. So you give mifepristone and your cortisol levels go up, but the high levels of cortisol can, for the most part, do nothing because the receptors are being blocked, at least temporarily. However, this is not a good situation, because there are some things that cortisol does which are not blocked by mifepristone. So those things will go on because there's more cortisol in the body. So this is not a good solution to prevent the effects of cortisol. It is a good solution and has been used in something like called psychotic depression. People who are depressed and have hallucinations, there's no other treatment available except electroconvulsive shock therapy. And there is a new attempt to use mifepristone to help to bring the psychotic attacks under control. I mean, one other aspect, you may maybe we haven't talked about the brain yet, and there are some really interesting aspects that sort of parallel the immune system and that get into exactly what we're talking about now. So I don't know if you want to.
Yeah, I would. Well, what are some of the interesting things you're learning about mood, for instance?
Well, let's go back to the basic idea that in, for example, the immune system, the acute stress response, these hormones help the immune system fight an infection. But chronically, they can cause problems, impairment of immune function. The brain is just the same way. There's a part of the brain that we have studied for many years called the hippocampus, which is named because it looked like a seahorse tail to early anatomists. And it's very important for learning and memory, the kind of memory that helps us keep track of events in our daily lives, what you're going to do this afternoon, what you did yesterday and this morning. It also keeps us oriented towards where we are. And it's the part of the brain that helps us remember where we were and what we were doing when, for example, September 11th occurred, the sort of indelible memories associated with place and time. When the hippocampus begins to fail, as it does in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, we lose that contact with who we are, with our daily lives, with the events. The hippocampus is very sensitive to stress hormones, to cortisol especially. But like the acute response in the immune system, these hormones actually help us remember where we were and what we were doing. They have a very important effect to stamp into our memories so that we can, the next time a situation like this occurs, we can perhaps avoid it. If it was like the place that where you ran into the lion, if you know not to go back there or to be particularly wary, that's going to help you survive another lion attack. That's the good side of stress hormone effects on the brain, on the hippocampus. The bad side is when we get into this chronic stress dysregulation, then the hippocampus shows allostatic load. Its nerve cells begin to shrink. Memory becomes impaired. There's part of the hippocampus which generates new nerve cells continuously through adult life, and these replacement of these cells is presumably very important for our ability to learn and remember things. This ability to produce new nerve cells is suppressed by chronic stress and even by certain kinds of acute stress. So the brain is very much part of the same system showing this protection in the short run and damage in the long run as all of these other systems of the body. And when we talk about mood, we talk about remembering where you were and what you were doing. If you have a functioning hippocampus, you are better able to associate place and time with a very emotionally powerful set of events. If you don't have a functioning hippocampus, then you're going to generalize. And the same cues that you can say, okay, this took place yesterday and I don't have to be worried about it today because it's a totally different situation. You may not be able to do that because, in fact, you generalize. People who have depression, people who have post-traumatic stress disorder tend to not be able to associate place and time, and they have then free-floating anxieties and flashbacks and things of that sort, which are at least partly related to having a malfunctioning hippocampus.
Dr. Bruce McEwen is the author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Dr. Bruce McEwen, the author of the new book, The End of Stress as We Know It. McEwen is the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University in New York. He studies the effects of long-term stress on the body, the impact stress has on our glands, our immune system, and the brain. Are there any implications for the research you're doing now on the effects of stress on the body? Any implications for things like chronic fatigue syndrome and these new mysterious syndromes that people seem to be developing that aren't easily diagnosed. Some doctors aren't even sure they exist. But for the people who are suffering from them, they know they have no strength, no energy, and they're very prone to all kinds of illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, certainly chronic pain and chronic fatigue, something that's called multiple chemical sensitivities, which amounts to probably the same set of syndromes of mm-hmm. Debilitation, lack of energy, are indeed very mysterious. And most likely they are related to an imbalance in the system I mentioned earlier, that is, inflammatory cytokines are produced in bursts, and they will make us feel very tired and even sick. Most of the evidence suggests that it's related to an imbalance, too much of these inflammatory cytokines, too little of the counter-regulatory systems like the cortisol, which can bring these systems under control. It's hard to document, to actually show that this is the main cause. I think that there are new attempts to really bring these disorders under some sort of more careful medical diagnosis. The question is then, what do you do about them? You have to somehow reduce these bursts of these inflammatory cytokines. It's not easy to figure out a way of doing this, but it is a direction that a lot of this research is moving, and I wouldn't be surprised over the next several years as if there will be some better sort of medical understanding of these conditions.
One of the larger problems we seem to be facing now in terms of stress and how our bodies respond to it is that our bodies are hardwired from the dawn of man era, when stress did mean that, you know, a brontosaurus was attacking, or some creature was attacking and you had to run away. I mean, do you think our bodies will ever adapt to the fact that the kind of stresses that we're often facing now are different? They're mental stresses. They're desk-related stresses. Mm-hmm. They're relationship stresses. And the response our body is providing for us isn't necessarily the response that we need.
Right. And I think we're talking about what direction will evolution be taking us, what selection yeah. mm-hmm. is made for people who are able to handle this kind of modern life stress.
Do you think our bodies will ever adapt to that?
Well, I think, I mean, one factor that is very important is this social support aspect. And people who, by their nature, are able to go out and establish networks of social contacts are doing themselves a big favor, because they're able not perhaps to directly deal with the sources of their stress, but to deal with how they handle them by perhaps realizing through interactions with other people that there are other aspects to life that are worth living, and relationships are as important or more important than the things that are causing them grief, and help to find a way to actually circumvent these situations. And of course, ultimately, if you're in a difficult job or a difficult relationship, you may have to leave it to find some other way of some other kind of relationship or some other kind of job. To have the courage to do that also requires good social skills and good ability to make decisions. So I think it's those kind of qualities that are perhaps, if you will, being selected for by evolution on top of this basic system, which is still very helpful when we get into dire emergencies.
Well, Dr. McEwen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Bruce McEwen is the head of the Neuroendocrinology Lab at Rockefeller University. His new book is called The End of Stress as We Know It. This is Fresh Air.